This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, deep roasting and blending coffee beans since 1966. Pete's.com or 800-999-2132.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, May 31st, 2006, and this is the KBOO Morning News. I'm Brian Smith. Coming up on this morning's program, 22 people were arrested in Olympia, Washington, during protests of military equipment in Iraq through the city's port. The Supreme Court has cut back on protections for whistleblowers on official misconduct, and the Afghan parliament has voted to prosecute the U.S. soldiers involved in yesterday's crash and subsequent shootings. Weather for today calls for clouds and rains with temperatures reaching the upper 70s.
Joe Keating, the Pacific Green Party candidate for governor, showed that he can think on his feet last Friday. Keating was preparing for a press conference in Portland's waterfront park when a reporter remarked that there was a document shredding truck in front of Portland General Electric headquarters the day after the convictions of Enron's two top officials. "Oh my God, this is wonderful," said Keating, who promptly ordered his supporters to pack up and move the press conference to the sidewalk in front of the document shredder. PGE was once an Enron subsidiary, and Keating said over the sound of chopped paper that he wants to continue to push for public ownership of the utility if he becomes governor. He also introduced that he said he would be the big grassroots efforts of his campaign, a bike patrol and broom brigade. Wearing neon Keating for governor vests, the volunteers say they'll be visible in the community sweeping sidewalks and cleaning broken glass and other messes out of bike lanes. After his press conference, a small group of volunteers set to work sweeping up around the document shredder. This from the Oregonian.
Police in Olympia arrested 22 more people yesterday as anti-war activists continue to protest a shipment of military equipment through the city's port on its way to Iraq. It was the most people arrested in a single day since the protests began a week ago. The Olympian newspaper reports that police used pepper spray several times on about 100 or so demonstrators. They later advanced on the crowd to try and disperse it. No one was seriously injured. Those arrested were taken to the Thurston County Jail for investigation of trespassing. The equipment being shipped through the port includes Stryker vehicles and other Army gear from Fort Lewis, a few miles north. A ship to carry the equipment arrived at the port on Monday.
Former talk show host Mary Sterrett, who recently helped start an anti-abortion group, says she plans to run for governor as the nominee of the Conservative Constitution Party. Sterrett said that she will seek the party's nomination when it holds a convention in Lake Oswego on Saturday. If Sterrett wins the nomination, she would be the only anti-abortion candidate in the race. Governor Ted Kulongoski, a Democrat and Republican challenger Ron Saxton, support a woman's right to choose. Saxton, however, said he would back some limits on the procedure, such as parental notification. The Constitution Party did not field a candidate in the 2002 governor's race because it did not want to draw votes from Kevin Mannix, the Republican candidate that year who shares the Constitution Party's opposition to abortion. Sterrett hosted a morning talk show on a Portland television station for more than a decade and later had a talk show on a Portland-based Christian radio station. She recently helped start an anti-abortion group called Oregonians for Life. The group has accused Oregon Right to Life, the state's largest organization opposing abortion, of being too willing to compromise. Bob Ekstrom, the chairman of the State Constitution Party, has said the party would field a well-known candidate in this year's election. He has yet to announce that it will be Sterrett. He added that the chosen candidate will make opposition to abortion a central campaign theme. The Constitution Party platform also stresses limited government and an official role for religion in public life.
One of three people accused of plotting to blow up targets in the name of the Earth Liberation Front is pleading guilty in California to conspiracy. Federal prosecutors say 20-year-old Lauren Weiner of Pound Ridge, New York, is agreeing to cooperate with investigators as part of her plea bargain. That includes testifying against 20-year-old Zachary Jensen of Monroe, Washington, and 28-year-old Eric McDavid of Forest Hills, California. They remain in Sacramento County Jail and face 5 to 20 years in federal prison if they are convicted of conspiring to use fire or explosives to damage property. The three men were arrested in January as they allegedly bought bomb-making materials at a Kmart in Auburn, California.
Four librarians spoke out for the first time yesterday after being subjected to a months-long gag order when the FBI demanded records about the library patrons under the Patriot Act. U.S. District Judge Janet Hall ruled last year that the gag order should be lifted, saying it unfairly prevented the librarians from participating in a debate over how the Patriot Act should be rewritten. But it wasn't until April that prosecutors dropped an appeal of that order. At a press conference, the librarians did little to hide their displeasure at being told by the government to keep quiet. George Christian of Windsor, Connecticut, and executive director of the Library Connection Incorporated, a consortium of libraries in the central part of the state, noted that the gag order was lifted only after Congress voted to reauthorize the Patriot Act, adding, "The fact that I can speak now is a little like being permitted to call the fire department only after the building has burned to the ground." The librarians are continuing to fight the FBI's request for information about their patrons. The Patriot Act, passed shortly after the September 11, 2001 attacks, allows anyone's records to be obtained if the FBI considers them relevant to a terrorism or spying investigation. Prosecutors argued that secrecy about demands for records is necessary to avoid alerting suspects and jeopardizing investigations.
Al Gore has made his sharpest attack yet on the George Bush presidency, describing the current administration as a renegade band of right-wing extremists. This according to The Guardian. In an interview, Gore calls himself a recovering politician, but launches into the political fray more explicitly than he has previously done during his high-profile campaigning on the threat of global warming. Denying that his politics have shifted to the left since he lost the court battle for the 2000 elections, Gore says if you have a renegade band of right-wing extremists who get hold of power, the whole thing goes to the right. Gore is promoting a documentary and book detailing the climate change's crisis he warns could literally end civilization. The new levels of attention he is receiving have led some Democrats to call on him to run again for president, while others have responded with anger that Gore did not show the same level of passion in the 2000 campaign.
Democrats have prepared for an upcoming Senate battle over repeal of the estate tax by releasing estimated savings the repeal could equal for oil executives and members of the Bush administration, according to Raw Story. The Senate is set to consider legislation to repeal the tax, which has been law since 1916, next week. At the time it was first repealed by President Bush, the tax applied only to estates worth more than $1 million. The current plan is to gradually phase the tax out until it is permanently repealed in 2010. Pointing to data indicating that 99% of the estate tax is paid by the highest earning 5% of Americans, a report released by the Democrats indicates that CEOs of major oil companies stood to gain significantly from a repeal. Democrats' estimates put oil company gains at least a $200 million windfall. The family of one oil executive, Lee Raymond, former ExxonMobil CEO, alone stood to receive a tax break worth over $160 million. Democrats have also once again issued a 2005 Government Reform Committee report indicating that repealing the estate tax would save the president, vice president, and 11 cabinet members anywhere from $91 to $344 million. The estimated cost of the repeal, according to Democrats, is $1 trillion for the years 2011 to 2021.
and activists from a coalition of environmental and public interest groups yesterday called on ExxonMobil shareholders to clean up the corporation's dirty practices. Those practices include conspiring with the government to invade Iraq and then making $7 billion in unearned profits from the war. An ExxonMobil spokesman said the company's profits are being misrepresented and its name being smeared. He said ExxonMobil pays for climate research programs at top universities and is working to reduce the industrial emissions from its own operations. But Valerie Reed of Consumers for Peace took advantage of the news conference to accuse ExxonMobil of conspiring with the Bush administration to invade Iraq in order to obtain cheap access to oil reserves. This from CNS News in Dallas.
The Supreme Court scaled back protections for government workers who blow the whistle on official misconduct Tuesday, a 5-4 decision in which new Justice Samuel Alito cast the deciding vote. In a victory for the Bush administration, justices said the $20 million public employees do not have free speech protections for what they say as a part of their jobs. Critics predicted the impact would be sweeping, from silencing police officers who fear retribution for reporting department corruption to subduing federal employees who want to reveal problems with government hurricane preparedness or terrorist-related security. Supporters said it will protect governments from lawsuits filed by disgruntled workers pretending to be legitimate whistleblowers. The ruling was perhaps the clearest sign yet of the Supreme Court's shifts with the departure of a moderate Justice Sandra Day O'Connor and the arrival of Alito. The ruling overturned an appeals court decision that said Los Angeles County Prosecutor Richard Ceballos was constitutionally protected when he wrote a memo questioning whether a county sheriff's deputy had lied in a search warrant affidavit. Ceballos had filed a lawsuit claiming he was demoted and denied a promotion for trying to expose the lie.
Severe weather continued to flare up across the Midwest and parts of the South yesterday, with storms also plaguing the Northeast and parts of the Rockies. Far east, severe thunderstorms developed over eastern New York and Pennsylvania, as well as southern Vermont and western Massachusetts in the afternoon. And scattered showers with isolated thunderstorms covered much of the northern Rockies and high plains, with snow pellets accumulating to 1 inch in the Yellowstone National Park.
With Republicans in the majority at the Federal Communications Commission for the first time in 14 months, the agency is poised to begin tackling a host of contentious issues, including changes to media ownership limits. This according to The Guardian. Senate confirmation Friday of Republican Robert McDowell to fill an empty commission seat marks the beginning of a more active phase at Chairman Kevin Martin's FCC, which has been idle on several fronts while deadlocked 2-2 between Republicans and Democrats. Even before McDowell was confirmed, the FCC chairman had begun circulating proposals among the other commissioners to reopen two issues: media ownership limits and requirements that cable operators carry multiple channels from local broadcasters after the transition to digital television instead of just one. A vote to reopen the debate of media ownership limits may occur at the FCC's regular scheduled meeting next month, agency officials said. The FCC will take a comprehensive look at what changes should be made, and the review isn't expected to be completed this year.
Some 1,500 more U.S. troops have arrived in Iraq to help with the war against Sunni Arab rebels, including al-Qaeda Islamist militants in the western desert province of Anbar, this according to Reuters. The military said that 2 battalion task force have moved into Iraq to assist in reestablishing the conditions necessary to enable effective local and provincial governance in providing additional security for the people of al-Anbar province. U.S. commanders, the White House, and Iraqi government have spoken of hopes for some American troops to go home this year, but say that will only happen as Iraqi forces are ready. The Pentagon said the troops are on a short-term deployment and would take from 15 to 16 the number of U.S. combat brigades in Iraq, but this did not raise the overall number of American troops in the country. Residents of Anbar's provincial capital, Ramadi, said they have noticed increased U.S. and Iraqi checkpoints and patrol activity in the city, and some families have quit the increasingly militarized city center in fear of a major U.S. offensive against the insurgents there.
Car bombs targeting Shiite areas tear through a car dealership in southern Iraq and a bustling outdoor market north of Baghdad yesterday as attacks nationwide killed 54 people and wounded 120 in the bloodiest day in recent weeks. Iraqi officials also said a key terrorist suspect who allegedly confessed to hundreds of beheadings was captured in a raid that also netted documents, cell phones, and computers that contain information on other wanted terrorists and Islamic extremist groups. The worst bombing hit the market as Iraqis were doing their evening shopping in the Shiite area of Husaynia, about 60 miles north of Baghdad. At least 25 people were killed and 65 were wounded.
And before yesterday's death, at least 4,066 Iraqis had been killed in war-related violence this year, and at least 4,469 had been wounded. This is based on Associated Press reports, and those may not be complete. During May, at least 871 Iraqis had been killed, surpassing the 801 killed in April. The deadliest month this year for Iraqis was March, when 1,038 were killed and 1,155 were wounded. The deadliest day for Iraqis this month was May 7th, when at least 67 civilians were killed.
According to the BBC, Iraq will investigate allegations that U.S. Marines carried out a massacre of civilians in Haditha in November. Nouri Maliki told Reuters news agency that there was a limit to the acceptable excuses for civilian casualties. The Pentagon is close to ending its own inquiries into the deaths, initially attributed to a clash with militants. Observers say the incidents could deal a more serious blow to us standing than to U.S. standing than the Abu Ghraib scandal. According to initial U.S. military reports, 15 civilians and 8 insurgents died after a bomb killed a Marine in Haditha. Speaking to Reuters, he said his government was worried by the increase in mistakes and would ask for answers not only about Haditha, but about any operation in which killing happened by mistake. He added, "We will hold those who did it responsible."
And the Afghanistan parliament has voted to call for the government to prosecute the U.S. soldiers responsible for a deadly road crash that sparked the worst riot in Kabul in years. Officials say the parliament passed a non-binding motion yesterday after debating on Monday's crash. A U.S. truck plowed into a line of cars, killing up to 5 Afghans and sparking citywide protest. A U.S. military spokesman says she has seen the motion and declined to comment. Hours earlier, a military spokesman told reporters that the driver of the truck was not suspected of any wrongdoing and had not been arrested. He said the truck's brakes are believed to have overheated and failed. The spokesman said he's been informed the overall toll from the unrest was 20 dead.
The U.S. military are claiming that the troops involved in the accident in the Afghan capital of Kabul yesterday fired in self-defense during the mass rioting following the crash, this from the BBC. The riots began after a U.S. military vehicle crashed into 12 cars in the Afghan capital, killing several people. People then started throwing stones, and the U.S. troops opened fire on the crowd. Other reports said Afghan security forces also opened fire. At least 7 people were killed in the shooting and the riots which followed. No U.S. soldier was hurt in the incident. The Army spokesman said that a preliminary investigation by the U.S. military has found that its soldiers retaliated in self-defense. At the height of the violence, 21 European Union diplomats and staff had to be rescued from their compound by British Royal Marines working for the NATO-led International Security Assistance Force.
And there are a couple of things to remember when you say Latin America. The term Latin, or Latino, emphasizes the influence of the conquering Spanish, particularly ignoring the reality of indigenous people who don't identify as Latino. And two, Mexico is part of North America, and many people south of the U.S. border object to the term American when applied only to people from the United States, because all 880,000 of us are Americans. KBOO's Patrick Engstrom-Poor has been traveling through parts of Latinized America since October of 2005. And for the last several months, he's been living in Petrar, one of South America's densest barrios. He brings us a 4-part series on life in Venezuela under the leadership of Hugo Chavez's Bolivarian Revolution.
The most visible manifestation of Hugo Chavez's 21st century socialism are the 20 or so misiones, or social programs, aimed at bringing the resources of the state directly to Venezuela's neediest. It's no accident that the name Missions evokes a military perspective. Chavez is a former paratrooper, and his supporters refer to him emphatically as Comandante. But the idea is not to militarize the daily lives of Venezuelans. It's to bring all of the resources and single-mindedness of military operations to work to improve the circumstances of people's lives. In fact, this government believes that in a time of peace, that is the function of the military, to serve the public. Captain Rommel Rangel, director of community development within the state-owned oil company PDVSA, explains further.
A person can't just stay in their bunker watching the reality that exists and not participate. We have to take advantage of the power of our armed forces. These days, one of the most strategic ideas of the president about the armed forces is to solidify a civic military union. The security of the country these days, the defense of the country, is a shared responsibility of the citizens and the armed forces.
One of the most successful missions is Mission Robinson, a literacy program started in July 2003 with the ambitious goal of eliminating illiteracy for 1 million people within a year, in a country that had about 1.5 million people unable to read and write. Chavez called the program the most important civilian military operation in the history of the Republic of Venezuela. In order to manage this, it was necessary to use the military to build roads and electrical plants in places where lack of infrastructure made study difficult or impossible. And more than 125,000 people volunteered as teachers and facilitated the delivery of materials to reach the goal. Venezuelan teachers used the Cuban literacy method called Yo Si Puedo, with training received from Cuban teachers in exchange for oil. The goal of teaching 1 million people to read and write was accomplished 6 months early. On October 28, 2005, in the presence of a UNESCO representative, the Venezuelan Congress signed an act declaring itself free of illiteracy. This means at least 95% of the country can read and write, and Venezuela hit 99%. Graduates of Mission Robinson were over 65% female, and this includes as well more than 7,000 participants with disabilities and 70,000 indigenous people who learned to read and write both in Spanish and their native language. Mission Robinson became Mission Robinson 2, with the goal of providing a sixth grade education to everyone. And this successful model has expanded greatly over the last 3 years, turning every social problem into a battle to address the basic needs of the formerly excluded majority. Mission Ribes provides access to high school education, and Mission Sucre provides advanced secondary education. This is particularly important because even though the universities are technically free, the competition for spaces based on achievement tests meant that it was more likely that people from a wealthier background would be more likely to win a spot in the university owing to their educational opportunities based on class privilege. But Mission Sucre is determined to provide college education to anyone that wants it and is prepared. Charlie Vargas is a Chilean student studying at the Bolivarian University through an educational exchange program that allows Venezuelans to study in other countries and bring students to Venezuela to improve the system through intercultural exchange of ideas.
In Venezuela, they have implemented an alternative model of education to contrast with the historical model imported from capitalism and neoliberalism. The education models in Latin America have always obeyed the logic, the practice, the ideology, and the theory of models imposed from without. Never before have they succeeded in establishing a definitive system of education that responds to the needs and the interests of their own country, and more specifically, to the interests of the people, to the interests of the excluded.
The functioning and success and shortcomings of the education missions could provide the material of an entire documentary, but it's important to mention that education is just one of the constitutional guarantees that this government is putting all of its energy toward fulfilling. Another very successful program is called Barrio Adentro. The goal of this health mission is to put a small free health clinic in every neighborhood, primarily to confront minor health problems before they become serious. This contrasts with the capitalist model that demands that people must reach emergency status before having access to social services. Alvaro Marquez is a member of a neighborhood health committee, which provides local oversight over the health of the community and the functioning of the health mission. He explains a little bit about how Barrio Adentro fits into a community.
Okay, the idea is, I say, to allow the community to help themselves in order to have a doctor at hand. Because, you know, if something happens in the middle of the night, now you have to have a doctor near your house. The doctors arrived. When they arrived, they brought this lab equipment. They were in these neighborhood medical modules. The clinics were right there in the room, and he would have his bed here.
This is a true model of preventative and community health care. From April 2003 to November 2005, 150 million visits were made to 733 health modules throughout the country. 1.2 million prescription glasses were provided to Venezuelans. Nearly 3 million laboratory examinations were carried out. The civic military mission concept of delivering social services has now expanded to over 20 areas. Misión Mercado buys food from campesinos and brings it into low-cost subsidized stores in the inner cities to both help farmers and reduce the cost of living in the poorer areas. Misión Vuelvan Caras provides job training to increase productiveness and reduce unemployment. Misión Negra Hipólita focuses specifically on the indigent population, making sure that people, especially children living on the streets, have a path towards a more stable life. Misión Habitat is focused on improving the living conditions in the barrios and helping with housing loans. Misión Guaycapuro ensures that the new constitutional rights of the indigenous populations are met, including the right to preserve their traditional lands and ways of living. Misión Milagro provides expert eye care and surgery. Misión Zamora assists campesinos in exercising their right to ownership of the land they work. There are so many issues surrounding these missions and lots of valid complaints, but what's important for a U.S. progressive audience is that Chavez has completely changed the dialogue of public administration. The dialogue in Venezuela is about how to go about meeting these needs more efficiently, or whether 1.5 million people really can read or write, or if the numbers were merely inflated, or whether campesinos have fully achieved their right to land, or whether the productive capacity of the country has been increased or not. And all of this makes Hugo Chavez an extremely popular president. These projects are visible, and they have changed the everyday lives of the majority of Venezuelans. From Venezuela, I'm Patrick Engstrom-Poor.
Youths torched a dozen cars and hurled stones at police in a second night of violence in the troubled Paris suburbs, raising memories of rioting that rocked the nation last year. Six police officers suffered light injuries and 13 people were detained in the riots last night and this morning. It did not appear to reach the scale of the first overnight clashes Monday night, when police said 9 officers were wounded and that they fired rubber pellets to disperse the roughly 100 youths. The tensions are a stark reminder of the anger that smoldered in depressed French suburbs. Despite new government efforts to tackle high youth unemployment and racial inequalities following the 3 weeks of similar but far worse rioting last fall, about 12 cars were torched before calm was restored around 1:30 a.m. At the height of last year's riots, more than 1,000 cars were torched in one night. The mayor's office said the trigger of this week's unrest was the arrest Monday of a suspect in the beating of a bus driver earlier this month. Many of those who rioted then were of immigrant origin, lying bare decades of discrimination and France's failure to integrate immigrants and provide opportunities for impoverished youths. Tension has remained high in the suburbs since the mayor banned teenagers from circulating in groups of more than 3 last month and ordered youths under 16 to be accompanied by an adult in public. A court later overturned the ban after protests from civil liberties groups.
And the Yangtze, China's longest river, is cancerous with pollution, according to the BBC. Environmental experts fear pollution from untreated agricultural and industrial waste could turn it into a dead river within 5 years. That would make it unable to sustain marine life or provide drinking water to the booming cities along its banks. The Yangtze rises in China's western mountains and passes through some of its most densely populated areas. The government has promised to clean up the river, which supplies water to almost 200 cities along its banks. But experts speaking on China's state media say that unless action is taken quickly, billions of tons of untreated industrial and agricultural waste and sewage are likely to kill what remains of the river's plant and wildlife species within 5 years. China's rapid economic development means that many of the nation's waterways are facing similar problems. Last year, the authorities announced that the country's second longest river, the Yellow River, was so polluted that it was not safe for drinking. Correspondents say that 300 million people in China do not have access to safe drinking water.
That's the KBOO Morning News for Wednesday, May 31st, 2006. Weather for today calls for clouds, rain, and highs in the upper 70s. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kbu.fm. Our producer for this morning's newscast is Brian Smith. Our assistant producer is Chris Andre. Our engineer is Boone Revis. And KBU Morning News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Angela Hancock Revis.
And I'm Brian Smith.
Stay tuned.